The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
I'm just checking audio levels first. Can you hear me, Corwin? Case 6 from the Gateless Gate Koan Collection. Once in ancient times, when the world-honored one was at Mount Gradrakuta, he twirled a flower before his assembled disciples. All were silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a smile. The world-honored one said, "I have the eye treasury of right Dharma, the subtle mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, and the flawless gate of the teaching. It is not established upon words and phrases. It is a special transmission outside tradition. I now entrust this to Mahakashapa." So this morning, I wanted to talk about just a couple of things in this koan that we haven't yet directly touched on in our wonderful talks from David Roshi and Dharma Holder Allen. The koan, as many koans are, is complex and rich, as the teachings are in Zen, the apparently contradictory teachings of Zen. Sometimes we say this and sometimes we say it's direct opposite. And even in this koan, I guess I will read the comment. I was thinking of not getting into it, but it's wonderful. This is Wu Men's commentary, which we usually don't read in connection with this koan when we're studying koans. But here's what Wu Men says about this encounter between the Buddha and his first Dharma heir, Mahakashapa. He says, "Gold-faced Gautama insolently degrades noble people to commoners. He sells dog flesh under the sign of mutton and thinks it is quite commendable. Suppose that all the monks had smiled, how would the eye treasury have been transmitted? Or suppose that Mahakashapa had not smiled, how could he have been entrusted with it? If you say the eye treasury can be transmitted, that would be as if the gold-faced old fellow were swindling people in a loud voice at the town gate. If you say the eye treasury cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha say that he entrusted it to Mahakashapa?" So right here, and as we've said, this is characteristic of Wu Men, who collected these koans, commented on them, and wrote little verses appended to them that we study as koans. The contradictory nature of the world is presented, because something happened between the Buddha and Mahakashapa, and then the Buddha says all this wonderful flowery language to confuse us, really. And then Wu Men, just in case we've gotten a little bit inflated about Zen, cuts it all down. It's typical of him to do this. It's typical of teachers to present one side and then the other. It's typical of this teaching to be heard as one thing and then another. But really, all of these contrasting conceptions, these mind constructions of reality, are not clear representations of reality. Reality is messy. It's strange and weird. It's unpredictable. It's full of difficulties and wondrous occasions. It's full of every single thing in the universe, with no exception. Every single thing in the universe is the Buddha Dharma. There are no exceptions. And that means that even you are contained within the embrace of the Buddha's teaching. And the Buddha himself is contained within it. It's said that at the end of the Buddha's life, after all of his wondrous teachings and hundreds, thousands of people coming to hear him, I had a dream once that I was in the assembly at Vulture Peak, that's the English translation of Gradrakuta, listening to the Buddha, but he was so far away, I couldn't hear him. And it was a little bit like the Monty Python skit where Jesus is preaching and people say, what did he say? What did he say? Blessed are the cheesemakers. The dream was just like that. Do I hear the teaching? Sometimes. Do I not hear the teaching? Sometimes. Do I understand it? Sometimes. Do I not understand it? Sometimes. This is, to me, the way life is. Sometimes there's clarity and sometimes there's confusion. And in Zen practice, we honor every situation that we find ourselves in. That's kind of an amazing thing, because most religious teachings and philosophical teachings, most ways of learning how to be a human being, psychology and many other ways of encountering the self, make right and wrong. We make this and that in these different systems, many of which I've studied and taught and practiced with. I'm sure many of you have too, that there's this and it should be that. And here's how to get to that. But in Zen practice, we say, as our ancestor Sengtsan taught us in the little piece we read from his great work, The True Entrusting of Heart Mind, the Xin Xin Ming, that there is no this or that, that there is no right or wrong. He doesn't mean that some things don't hurt and are destructive. He doesn't mean that some things please us. But really, the panorama of reality is endless, and we keep forming opinions about it. And it's our opinions that keep us from having a life where we can encounter each moment fully, whether it's painful and distressing or joyous. If we can't experience the painful and the distressing, we can't experience the joyousness either. There is only this moment after moment after moment. And this great moment when the Buddha picks up a flower and twirls it around. He doesn't just pick up the flower and show the flower, he does something with it. A very significant part of this koan that he twirls it around. He is showing what Sengtsan was showing in the poem, Xin Xin Ming. He's saying, it's a flower, it's nothing, and it's everything. Here's what it can do. Here's what I can do. I can twirl it around. He's showing that even the conceptions of form and emptiness are false constructions of the mind. The little black boxes we talked about a little bit yesterday that seem to represent reality. We do this all the time. Flower. Oh, we know what that is. Bird, floor. And then it gets really dangerous. Then it gets really damaging when we say, Melissa, Will, David. This is when we have to be very careful, when we make a black box of a construction about ourselves, and we do it all the time. We begin to learn who we are and we don't like it. So then we embark on the great journey of self-realization or self-improvement. And all the time the Buddha has taught for 2,600 years, and his teaching resonates through all of these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. If you look for the self, you won't find it. Because it isn't anything solid. It isn't anything that is only this thing. It's constantly in flux, in motion. There's nothing we can point to. And yet we all have our ways of constructing reality, of course. So we construct a self based on all of the things that have ever happened to us that we remember. You know, there are billions and billions of things that have happened that we have no memory of at all. We selectively cherry pick little events in our lives and we put them into a narrative. And then we say, yep, that's me. I am the one who is completely fucked up, or maybe just a little fucked up, or weird, really, really weird, strange, quirky. And we try very hard, once we've discovered this about ourselves, to hide it from the rest of the world. And we construct not only a reality for the self, the internal negative reality, perhaps. I think there are some people who construct a positive reality of themselves. I have to say, I've never met anybody like that, but I bet they exist. And I bet they don't come to Zen or to Dokusan. So I just haven't met them, or to therapy or to mindfulness classes, which I used to teach. They're busy doing whatever it is they're doing. I don't know what they're doing, but they're not so interested in looking inward and finding out what is the truth about this strange, broken, damaged being that I'm doing my best to pretend isn't really me. And we show this false mask to the world of normality, but inside we're really strange. One of the things I have to love about Zen is also really strange. Some of you have figured that out. It's really weird. What is this borrowing of forms and practices from hundreds and sometimes thousands of years ago, constructed around a sesshin where we are put into a pressure cooker and the dial gets turned all the way up and we're not allowed even to take the lid off because the food is still cooking. We don't even know what's happening for us in this pressure cooker of practice. Even not going to sesshin, the stakes of Zen are very high. Because ultimately, as Alan said last night, we are going to die to the self. We're going to be bitten by the poisonous snake. We are going to lose trust in this vivid reality we've constructed about who we are. And not only that, but what the world is like. Ultimately, all of these ideas drop away. And what they're replaced with is not just bird or floor, or tree, or Melissa, or David, or Will, they are replaced with, I don't know what this is. Tweet, tweet, tweet. Ouch. Oh no. Yes. Beautiful. Whatever it is. This constant stream of experience. And we learn to swim in this constant stream of experience as Zen practitioners. Now, the thing is, I'm telling you all this right now based on my own experience, and I know that everybody in this room has had slightly or really, really severely different experiences, because we're all human beings inside a bag of flesh with a little brain that's constantly creating neural pathways to have thoughts that are really robust. If you ever really look at your thoughts, and I'm hoping that anybody who has practiced Zen has done this at least a little bit, you start to see that they're not that interesting. They're the same ones over and over and over again. Most of them having to do with, I like this, I don't like this, I want this, I don't want this, directed towards the self or other people. It doesn't even matter, but they're constant and they're repetitive and they're just not that creative. Every once in a while, a creative thought comes. I just love when somebody tells me one of them. Creative, partly because they're not one of my litany of thoughts. There's just a limitation on what the mind can do. We can't stop the mind. Well, we can. I mean, we can become brain damaged and stop the mind that way. But we can't stop it from its incessant chattering. What we can learn to do is not take it so seriously, not take what the mind tells us as gospel. And when we stop investing energy in it, whether we stop fighting it, which gives it a lot more energy, and then the thoughts get even worse. Anybody who's woken up in the middle of the night with a consuming set of thoughts knows that if you try to stop it, that it just gets worse. And then sleep disappears. And harmony disappears. But if you kind of let it be. One of my favorite quotes I've said to somebody recently, but I've said a lot to a number of you, is from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Shinryu Suzuki Roshi's collection of transcribed talks, where he talks about how you control your sheep, comparing it to the mind. You give it a bigger meadow. You control the mind by not trying to control your thoughts or get rid of them or smash them to pieces. You control the mind by giving it more space so that the thoughts can just keep going on in the background. And at certain points, you don't even hear them. They come back, thank goodness, because you wouldn't be able to do things like get a new license plate or go shopping even at the grocery store. But they no longer torment you with their certainty, their delusive certainty about who you are and what the world is. We're caught in these tiny little boxes of delusive certainty about ourselves. And Zen chips away at that delusive certainty, even about the nature of the mind. So I'm talking to you about all this. I'm basing it on my experience. And I don't know if any of it is connecting to any of you, because I actually cannot read minds. If you think I can, we should talk about that. No one can really, but of course we can get an empathic sense of what's going on with another person. That definitely happens, and it's a wonderful thing when it happens. We can't be certain, so we have to check it out, or we have to just listen and receive information and say, oh, this person must be thinking that. And then there's suddenly a revelation of the person in front of us, of a unique human being who's not us. That's a very important step in maturation. But we have to also do this with ourselves. We have to not take our narratives for granted. And here in this little story, this story which has become seminal in Zen Buddhism, it's not a story you'll find in Buddhism in general, as David mentioned yesterday. It is part of our cultural inheritance from Chinese history about 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, but doesn't go all the way back to the Buddha. But this story is significant because, as I said earlier, Zen is weird. And two of the things that are really weird about it are transmission and the teacher-student relationship that flowers, if you will, in Doksan. The capacity to be perceived as you are behind your mask with another person who is also showing you who they are behind their mask is a rare occurrence indeed. It is a heart-touching, heart-warming experience. I have been lucky in my life to have it a number of times. And where it really manifests for me is not with my family, who I love dearly, not with my friends who are non-Buddhist or non-Zen practitioners, who I also love dearly. Get little glimmers of this kind of true connection, I call it. But with some Zen students, with my teachers, with my colleagues, sometimes there's more than a glimmer. There's a dropping away of the walls, of the masks. There's a dropping away of the narratives. And there's just two people who love the Dharma being together in one space. There's a beautiful quote that I love from Rumi. Sadly, I haven't been able to find it on the internet recently, but I will give you my version of it. He himself, Rumi, who lived in the 13th century in Persia, he practiced with a teacher, a heart teacher named Shams, and the two of them had a similar connection to what we see demonstrated between Shakyamuni Buddha and Mahakashapa. A true meeting, heart to heart. And Rumi has many poems about Shams, who was apparently a very odd person, a very weird soul. And he drew Rumi, who was actually a pretty ordinary person at the beginning, married and he had a regular job, into this other landscape where the narratives and the nature of the self became unknown, looser. And they were so connected that Rumi was able to just not write poetry, but speak poetry without any kind of writing, revision, thought, as he was twirling sometimes because he was a Sufi, as he was sitting in meditation, and his dear student would write down the words. And all the Rumi poems we have, and there are many, many of them, come from that just outward manifestation of his heart in his words. And he says, what is the true connection between people? What is the true connection between people? And then he answers himself a little bit like our friend Yunmen. He says, it's when the same knowledge opens a door between them. Then they are called to be companions. This is, I believe, what's happening when Shakyamuni twirls the flower. Mahakashapa's smile is a smile of recognition. Maybe every once in a while you have this experience just listening to a Dharma talk. Something gets said that you don't object to. Something gets said that makes you go, oh, yes. That's a moment like this. That's a moment like the person in the crowd really hearing Jesus's words and understanding that he's blessing the cheesemakers. Sometimes it's like that, but sometimes it's beyond any conception. And it's just, oh, yes. And there's nothing to do in that moment, really. Tears come to our eyes. The body loosens a little. There's a recognition of something beyond the tormenting narratives, the little boxes of the self and other, the little boxes of reality that we've thrust everything into. When we work with the koan mu, this is what happens, because everything gets a new name. Instead of tree or floor or David or Will, it's just mu, 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 the answer that the great teacher Jiaozhou gave to a student who was lost in his own constructions and really, really wanted to know, do dogs have the Buddha nature? Even though that was Jiaozhou's teaching, everything has the Buddha nature. You have the Buddha nature. You are the Buddha nature. You are one who is already awake, as Dogen says again and again and again, but you just don't know it. And the reason you don't know it is because of your constructions and because of the if onlys. If only I could get rid of all my thoughts. If only I could be calmer. If only I could be happier. If only I could be a little bit nicer and stop being reactive and stop being, you know, I'm not even going to go on. Because there's probably as many of those internal voices tormenting us as there are people listening right now. And in that dream I had about being on Vulture Peak, I couldn't hear the Buddha's teaching, but I felt it. I remember waking up from that dream, and it was probably 30 or 40 years ago that I had this dream. I was just starting out as a Zen student. I didn't understand Zen at all. I don't know if I understand it now, but I have to talk about it. It's my job. But I've understood something that was beyond words and letters, a teaching that is so direct and so demonstrated in this koan by the story of these two people, human beings who woke up every morning from sleeping and had to go to the bathroom and wash up and get dressed, just like us. Shakyamuni Buddha did all those things. He was not a magical, mystical being. He was not a god, and neither was Mahakashapa. Mahakashapa, one of the three Kashapa brothers who were disciples of the Buddha. There were thousands of people who came to the Buddha to learn what he was teaching, the liberating teaching of Suffering exists, and you can wake up in the middle of it and have a full life without changing anything about yourself or the way things are, except to learn to pay attention and not to be fooled by your thinking. His mother had died. His stepmother, his son, his wife, many, his cousins, people from all over India and surrounding areas came to study with him. But by the end of his life, even Ma Kashyapa had left him. There were only a couple of people left. These moments of connection are also not a solid thing. They're fleeting. Even for the Buddha, this was true. He died with one servant with him. He died because, according to one story, somebody had served him poison mushrooms to kill him. They'd actually given them to somebody else, and he said, "No, I'll eat those," knowing full well what they were, serving others right to the end of his life, but no longer surrounded by all of the people who had touched his heart over the many years of his teaching. And of course, I don't even have to talk about Jesus's death. Talk about abandonment. Talk about nothing lasts. And this is why it's so important to understand Maha Kashyapa's smile. A momentary exposition of the true connection between people. Once you taste it, you can forget about it, but hopefully you won't. Hopefully, and this is where transmission comes in, you'll cultivate these moments again and again and again until you know, and I believe the Buddha knew this and I believe Jesus knew it, you know that you are not alone in the universe. You are surrounded by the Buddha Dharma, which manifests as everything, the air you breathe and the food you eat and the people who cook the food. You are surrounded by, I'm going to use this word, the four-letter word, love. You are. You don't have to believe me. The way to get there is not to strive for it. The way to get there is not to say, yep, I get it. Thank you. Thanks for your teaching. Got to go watch something on TV. The way to do it is to say, oh, yes, I have felt that myself. I got to go walk the dog and watch TV. I hope you hear this. I hope you hear that your life and your secret self is the awakened heart of the Buddha. I believe this was behind Maha Kashyapa's smile. And I believe that this is why the Buddha said, "You got it, baby. You got what I'm teaching. I'm handing it over to you." And Ma Kashyapa eventually handed it on to Ananda, another person in the Sangha of the Buddha, and on and on and on and on to this moment. Who knows if any of those people even existed, but the idea of the transmission is that something has been touched heart to heart for generations and then manifests itself in the present moment, in our teaching, and our receiving of the teaching. Once in ancient times, when the world honored one was at Mount Gradrakuta, he twirled a flower before his assembled disciples. All were silent. Only Ma Kashyapa broke into a smile. The world honored one said, "I have the eye treasury of right Dharma, the subtle mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, and the flawless gate of the teaching. It is not established upon words and phrases. It is a special transmission outside tradition. I now entrust this to you." Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and our servers come out. We've been told that we can't be heard on this microphone, the three of us, so we're going to use a microphone. And where is it? Oh, thank you, Bill. And who has the other microphone?
Bill has it. So Bill, you'll be in charge of looking for people raising their hands. And we'll call on people if you raise your Zoom hand, and we'll call on people here if you raise your actual physical hand. So we'll start with Betty.
Hi, thank you for your talk, Melissa. And especially since for some reason you were able to talk without having the background noise, that really helped a lot. So I really appreciated that. So something came up for me during this talk, and I just have to say a couple things before I get to that. I have three sisters, but one of them a number of years ago wrote me an Easter card. And my sister's an evangelical Christian, and she had to tell me something very important and difficult in this Easter card. She had to let me know that I really needed to accept Jesus in my heart. And I was upset by it. At the time, I was very active at the Providence Zen Center, and I was very active in my Unitarian church. So I felt like I had two religions. And it didn't seem my sister thought those counted for anything. But and probably if she had done it a few years before that, I would have gotten really pissed off at her and yelled at her and told her where to jump off. But I didn't do that. However, I never spoke with her about it. It's just been this kind of wall between us. And I guess to make a long story short, during your speech, your talk, I realized, well, Jesus is really a bodhisattva. And but I thought, you know, I don't know if I would say that to her, because I'm not sure that where she's coming from, she would really think that that was a good thing, because I think from her point of view, there isn't anything. If you're not a Christian, you're not anything. So, but I have been thinking about having a talk with her, because this Christian stuff, she did it with one of my other sisters recently. My other sister had gotten into an automobile and a bike accident, and she's still recuperating. And I guess she thought Catherine was, you know, had come close to death, which she could have died, you know, a little bit worse, she could have died. So she decided she had to call Catherine on the phone, and Catherine couldn't interrupt her. She had to say this to her. She had to tell her that she needed to accept.
Yeah. Jesus. So Betty, I'm going to stop you there. How wonderful to, you know, things happen and we think, oh, it was really like that. And I love this. Oh, Jesus was a bodhisattva. These words we use that as human beings, we so often use them to divide. How dare you say Buddha? You know, you must say Jesus. Or how dare you say Jesus? Yeah. But I hear you dropping beneath that.
Yeah.
I think Sung San was once asked if he believed in Jesus as the one true way. And he said, of course I do. Right? There is only one true way. And it feels like when we get beneath this, when we touch what you're touching, Betty, we see there's something beyond words and letters. So thank you for sharing that.
Anybody in the Zendo? Yep, Jenny.
And Bill, you can sit over here and Jenny will take it to the next person.
Person to person, a transmission, a microphone.
thank you for the talk, Melissa. The phrase, don't become overjoyed, has been in my mind. And I was wondering what reading it was from when we read it today. It was from Days Like Lightning. And I love Sashin. And I was like awake last night. Am I overjoyed?
I always think of the person who came to 3 weeks of our coming and going session when we used to do that. And he was really into it. And at the end, he said, I'm over meditated. And we never saw him again. Yeah. So it's a funny line. You know, we're supposedly revising the sutra book. And one of the things I want to do with that text is find the original and see what the words really were. My sense of that is
don't overdo it, you know, and I would say in light of what I was just talking about, don't make a construction about it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is so great. This is so, boy, that can be, it's just like saying, this is so terrible. This is so terrible. It's the same. So I think that's what it's pointing to. That's my sense.
Yeah, the middle way is what comes up for me when I hear that. It's like, oh yeah, overjoyed is a little bit too far off to one side of the middle way. And this middle way, is, there's such wisdom in that.
Thanks, Jenny.
And we also might say, when the joy comes, let the joy kill you. Be so joyous, there's no one left outside of that.
I just have to say it's really delightful to be the middle way between these two. Yeah, thanks, Jenny. Deborah online.
Thank you for the teaching, Melissa Roshi. So in the koan, I heard something like, this teaching exists outside of the tradition. And yet we have a long tradition. So I'm wondering if you can help me to understand what that means with regards to institutions and traditions.
Thank you. We're laughing in agreement with your noticing yet another version of the Zen paradox, right? So there's no tradition. And on some level, that's really true. Every human being who encounters the way encounters it freshly. There's nothing really to inherit. You know, this is, and yet the other side of this is there are all these traditions that we keep alive. Well, who really knows, right? Over 2,600 years, things really can change. And we don't know what it was like in ancient times. We can do a lot of historical study and figure it out. But my feeling is that that whole little speech of the Buddha's, it's very famous, of course. It's a teisho in itself, right? It just, everything is contradictory in it. And then Wu Men contradicts it still further. You know, he's selling dog meat, shouting at the gates. And in a way, I think that's a great expression of respect for the Buddha's teaching. Don't buy it. Mm-hmm. It's rotten dog meat. It's old and crappy. Instead, check it out, right? And just see what could I actually take from these teachings that resonates with me. So both are true.
I love your question because there's a tradition that is sort of the gateway to presenting this wonderful story, right? But then when it all comes down to it, you know, there's the flower and the smile.
Thanks, Deborah. So somebody in the Zendo? Good choice, Jenny. Not because it wasn't you, but just it's easier. Yeah, right.
So I'm Christine. One of the things that I
Sorry, I don't know if that microphone is actually turned on because it doesn't seem to be changing. And also just make sure to speak into the end.
Yeah, the ice cream. So try it again.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm Christine. One of the things I tend to struggle with is I love the fact that I know that I am constantly changing, and that's the same for like everybody around me. But to have people who will expect me to behave as I did 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and take the stance that, oh, people don't change, yet they, you know, they sometimes make me doubt, like, oh, so maybe I'm not doing this right. So yeah, I can just find that a little struggling at times.
When our daughter was little, Melissa and I used to go on separate retreats. So she would go off and I would be at home and then I would go off. And Every time she came back, I never knew who the person was when Melissa would come back. Who is this person? And because it was clear that there is this change, and it is true that people want us to be dependable, and they want us to be who they think we are, or they think they want us to be who, right? And so I think as we deepen relationships, part of deepening comes from disillusionment. And it's very difficult because we get into this mirror of, I want to be who I think you think, I think you think that I want to be, right? And so then we try to take care of the other one. Well, let me be who I think, you know, so something nice about that, to care what's going on. But as we walk this path, and as we just walk the planet, right, outside of this tradition, we begin to see we can only be who we are in the moment, and who we are isn't even who we think we are, right? So, and to see that the gift you have to give your family, the people, your coworkers, is not trying to do the mind game of giving them what you think, they think, you think, they think. But of showing up in some authentic way and seeing what happens. It's a dangerous business, but not nearly as dangerous as the other business.
Thank you.
Esther.
So I like the idea too of the constant changing. And so when I find myself in habitual energies, recurrences, returning selves or behaviors that I'm not so fond of, meeting that can be difficult. And so important, I think, that you know, there is both the constant change and the not knowing and the showing up and to see what happens when we meet with old friends or new people. And at the same time, meeting as best we can when some of those repetitive patterns and behaviors and when they show up. And so this, maybe you could speak of how do we meet that with compassion and patience, I guess. Trust is the word I'm thinking about.
Michael and I, I'm going to start. Yeah. Thank you, Esther, for bringing that up. What?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that okay? Thank you for bringing that up. yeah. I could go on, but these repetitive patterns, these almost knee-jerk reactions that all of us have, we hate them. Right? We want them to go away. We're really impatient with them. I think that's what you're pointing to. And, you know, I don't think I've fully learned this, but I have an inkling of knowing this, that they also are the Buddha Dharma. They really are. They're a part of the Buddha nature. They're not going to change by us hating them. The energy of hatred seems to bring on like a stronger version of them, you know, these robust neural pathways that make us react some physically before we even think it. You know, the body reacts first before the mind catches up. That's the newest research. It's actually been around for a long time, but now it's in the popular culture. Even when we move our hand, the body did that before the mind, and the mind remembers having moved the hand and says, oh, I just moved my hand. I just moved my hand. It's just such an interesting thing. I reacted to being instructed about how to use the microphone. Right? Everywhere, it's everywhere. And it's just to appreciate the thing about these old patterns too. They're old patterns. We hate them,
but they're really comfortable because they're familiar. What's familiar is just, even though it's horrible and is destroying us, it's our, we go back to it because I know this. I don't know that. I don't know what's going to happen. No, it's not unrelated to Christine's comment. It's not just other people in our lives who don't like it when we change. It's us. We don't like it when we change. Where's the old reliable jerk that's named Melissa? You know, where did she go? So let me just be a jerk and then, you know, I'll be comfortable again. It really does happen that way. It's amazing. So to embrace everything as the Buddha Dharma, this is where it all comes down to Zen practice. There's also all kinds of wonderful, skillful means of psychological counseling and different methods that can be used here. But for me, that's the essence point. You know, this is it too. Thank you. Did you want to say more?
No. Yeah.
Yes, go ahead, Michael. Michael's going to blow us away.
Wow. Yeah. So, Esther, I was going to say smile. And I don't mean that smile as in happy smile. I mean smile as in recognition that you are a human being who experiences a multitude, an infinite amount of experiences. And you are, and these are just one of them. You're a jewel of the universe. And so am I. And so is Melissa and David and everyone else. But that the smile of recognition, I think is how I would kind of meet that, you know? Yeah, this too, this too.
Thank you. Thanks, Esther. Paul.
Yeah. Actually, what you just said, Michael, is very much related to where I was connecting, I think, with your talk, Melissa, and just that and I know sometimes this word can be a little difficult, but the intimacy, that that connection, that awareness of, you know, sharing that same space. It really resonated with me. And there's also this realization that it's not always smiles. Like I feel like those moments where I feel like I'm sharing a space, it's just as often with a tear. There's this vulnerability that I think that can arrive in a smile or cracking up, as Alan was saying last night. I love that image. Just bawling, you know, just this willingness to be open. And as much as I love that image of the twirling, the flower and the smile, there's so much more than that smile. I guess that's just really what's for me. I look around all this Zendo, as we're trying to figure this out, whatever it is, and there are the you know, little stubbing of toes or you know, discomfort and pain, and I see the pain, and with that person. You know, and I know this pain. I know the pain as I have it, but it does seem to keep coming back to this idea of willingness to be seen, this willingness to see and be seen. And I think that's really what I heard in your talk, Melissa. It just struck me.
I'd just respond and say, you're right. There is so much more. And it's everything.
Yeah. And just to mention this, allowing ourselves to be seen, Sesshin is such a wonderful time to practice this, right? Because of the privacy we grant to each other, the custody of the eyes. So don't have to worry, am I looking like a good Zen student with the snot coming down from my nose? But to realize, as Melissa said, this is a really different way of being, right? And that we can practice showing our smile and showing our tears and opening our heart without saying a word or moving a muscle. Am I courageous enough to sit here as myself, not putting on clothes for myself or for anyone else? We just sitting here. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Corwin.
Thank you for the talk, Melissa. Yeah, when you started out, I was thinking, wow, she's talking about me, because you were talking about people who thought they were fucked up and weird. but then you went on to say, I forgot exactly how you put it, but something about, you know, people who think they're normal or not fucked up and weird, or, you know, they don't go to Zen, or they probably wouldn't go to Zen or Dokusan or therapy. And you know, I thought of a friend of mine who's sort of a marginal part of his Zen community, rarely sits with anybody else, is kind of proud that he doesn't need Dokusan. But then I thought, I can only really talk about me, but I'm pretty sure that all of us do that at some point where we think we know. And I was kind of equating being normal with being right. Like, you know, oh, those Christians have it wrong, we Zen people have it right, and we're the normal ones, they're the weird ones. And just how all of that is just the delusions that we face, that we have all the time of, you know, I'm right, or even the delusion that I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just thought of, you know, Mahakashyapa just sitting there and just smiling, because that's all it was. There was a flower being twirled, they're smiling, there was no right, no wrong, there just was. Mm-hmm. And it just sent my mind into this weird thing of just, then I was the person who was analyzing rather than just being, but then, yeah, I was also just the person who was analyzing. So, it just touched me very deeply. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's an important last comment, I think, you know, that when we become the person who's analyzing, when we look at other people and imagine what's going on inside behind their mask, you know, and sometimes I think it's really scary to lower your mask, right? We usually don't do it. And year after year after year of coming to Sesshin, doing Dokusan, wears the mask away, but sometimes it just makes it stronger. And so somebody can say, I don't need Dokusan, I already know everything, you know, and that's the Buddha Dharma too, manifesting as certain kind of arrogance, you know, certain kind of, who needs a teacher? That's actually prevalent in American Zen. There's places that don't have teachers, you know, because teachers are full of shit. Teachers are full of shit, but I think we still need them, you know, right? We need somebody to guide us through the wildness of our lives. And I'm looking to Paul, because I think that you're equating this to intimacy. I'm glad you used that word. It is a kind of intimacy that not everybody is not willing to do, sometimes not capable of in their own life journey. So it's not that there's something wrong with them or this friend of yours, Corwin, but it happens to be where they are. So, you know, that's another learning, certainly in teaching, is to let people be where they are. And then when that little crack happens, it's just, oh my gosh, it just touches me so much. And I have a real issue myself with my capacity to see the Buddha Dharma in other people. Because when I see it and I see the mask in front of it, sometimes I get a little impatient. And so I've been working on that for years, just allowing people to have their lives. And then when they're ready to meet, I'm ready. I'm ready to meet them. Yay, you came to the party. How wonderful. But there's no other, I don't want to impose a path on another person. Right. So, okay. Let's see. Anybody else? Oh, yes. We had, it's Paul's choice. But we'll get to you, maybe. So,
I'm Deb. Thank you. What I noticed is what came up for me when you're talking about like letting go of the box of who we are and our name and everything. So what came up for me was, what is there if there's no box? What is there?
Yes. Right. What is there? Right. A wonderful teaching. Right. Look and look. Just observe and observe. Finally, you will laugh out loud. They say.
Or cry.
Yes.
Yes. What is there? This is intimacy. Right. Yeah.
And I love the way you phrased it, because you used the word letting go of the box. We don't actually let go of the box. It goes on its own. If we let go, we're interfering with a natural process, right? It's more like getting rid of. You can't. And I know people. I once worked with a man who had pretty serious mental health problems, and he had had a great awakening to the Buddha Dharma. But also had these mental health problems. So the combination was that he made a vow once he saw through the self to never use the words I, me, or mine. And man, it was really hard to talk to him. But you know, he was really committed to it, because this is what happens.
Yeah.
Everything drops away, and then you grab at it to put it back together. Sometimes really fast. And then it's all sloppy and weird, and, you know, but he was also a beautiful person who was doing his best to live his experience. So I don't think we I want to warn people not to try to let go of anything, but to trust that being present to the practice dissolves. It's more like somebody once described, it's more like WD-40. It's not a solvent, and it's not a, what do they say in their advertising? Lubricant. It's not, is it a lubricant? Is it a solvent? That's what the Dharma is. It's like is it a breath mint? It's also a breath mint. You still have to brush your teeth though. So just to trust that this experience where David just met you in it, you felt it. We kind of all, I mean, I felt it. That's it. You didn't do that by letting go of the black box of the self. It's who you really are. Thank you. Yeah. So I know I just want to go to Zeph, since he had his hand up already, and we'll take you as the last person to offer something.
Okay. Got it. So I've been going around my life listening for Mahakashapa's smile, and I have my kind of trip report. So when I was serving somewhere around here, somebody apparently sang something wrong, and they realized I didn't realize it. And then they broke out in laughter right in the middle. And I thought that was nice. And then another one, when we were reading the Five Remembrances, I'm of nature to grow old. Somehow that's a kind of more wistful Mahakashapa smile. You know, the flower twirling is, oh, this is really nice. It's also passing. The other thing that the other image that comes, it's like a fake memory or something. Some girl I dated, I really liked, you know, we're walking along and you turn and you just smile. Right. And the thing that came up is smile has this recognition that we talked about, but I think there's like, oh yeah. There's this kind of waking up, realizing, you never intend to smile. It just happens. And then you go, oh, wow. Well, what's going on here? Anyway, yeah.
Thank you, Zeph. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about how we've been talking a lot about right and wrong and self, no self, and that thing. And I think that the thing that comes up the most is that we're so sure we're right, or we're so sure we're wrong, or we're so sure about it. Melissa said something really in her talk where she said the Buddha said that if you look for self, you can't find it. Didn't say there is no self, right? It's just what's here right now. And just what Deb said, what is there? what is this? If we take away the box, what is it? What's there? And that right there, standing on the precipice of the question. Yeah, that's where the magic is, the golden nugget.
So thank you everyone, and we will resume our practice.